yourself. We want to thank you all and appreciate you for supporting KBOO and keeping us strong.
And those of you who are eligible to vote, consider voting and picking up your voter ballot and voting.
Yes. And if you have any questions, like we told you earlier about voting safety, do check out the Oregon Secretary of State website, which is sos.oregon.gov. And you can get more information. Go ahead, Cecil.
No, I'm going to say, and it depends on where you are located when you're hearing this. So whatever municipality, whatever state, there are similar election authorities. So whether you are in Guam or whether you are in Berlin or whether you are in a town in Oregon, John's Day, there are people who are able to help and assist you. Hey, thank you so much for being a part of this community. Thank you, Celeste. And thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Cecil. And thank you, Ray. And we'll hear you next week.
KBOO is holding its monthly Board of Directors meeting live at KBOO Studios on Monday, October 24th, starting at 6 p.m. The public is invited to attend. Due to COVID concerns, masks and proof of vaccination are required for all persons. KBOO is located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland. That's Monday, October 24th at 6 p.m. for the next Board of Directors meeting.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland.
Listen,
laugh,
learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
I'm Mr. KBOO.FM. Them should know it's accurate. Kabaka Pyramid say watch your step, you know what I mean?
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Yo soy de un pueblo pequeño, pequeño como un gorrión, con medio siglo de sueños, de vergüenza y de valor. Yo soy de un pueblo sencillo como la palabra Juan, como el amor que yo entrego, como el amor que me dan. Yo soy de un pueblo nacido entre fusil y cantar, que de tanto haber sufrido tiene mucho que enseñar. Hermano de tantos pueblos que han querido separar, porque saben que aún pequeños juntos somos un volcán. Porque saben que aún pequeños juntos somos un volcán.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I will be your host for the next hour. The music you just heard was from the classic song Yo soy de un pueblo sencillo, or I'm from a simple people, by Nicaraguan singer and songwriter Carlos Mejia Godoy. Mejia used his music during the Nicaraguan Revolution of the 1970s to support and promote the Sandinista cause. The news these days is full of a new wave of immigrants from countries like Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala in the so-called crisis of immigration at our southern border. But the history behind the latest surge of Central American migration is rarely mentioned. Today, we're going to revisit the history of the Central American revolutions following World War II and the U.S. interventions to defeat revolutionary movements and make Central America safe for American capitalists. In the following interview with Sasha Lilly, historian Aviva Chomsky notes that with the passage of time, some things are remembered and others are forgotten. In the case of Central America, she argues, amnesia has been consciously fostered. U.S. support for repressive regimes and policies often vanishes in discussions about contemporary violence in Central America and migration from the region. Chomsky contends that the history of resistance to U.S. intervention needs to be recovered and remembered. In this episode from the radio show Against the Grain, Sasha Lilly speaks with Chomsky about the hidden history and why it's important to remember. Against the Grain is hosted by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song on KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. It's a program of ideas, in-depth analysis, and commentary on political, economic, social, and cultural issues important to radical thinking and activism. This segment originally aired on September 13, 2022.
Today on Against the Grain, with the passage of time, some things are remembered and others forgotten. According to historian Aviva Chomsky, in the case of Central America, amnesia has been consciously fostered. The long history of United States support for repressive regimes and policies often vanishes in discussions about contemporary violence in Central America and migration from the region. Chomsky contends that the history of resistance to U.S. intervention, both in Central America and the United States, also needs to be recovered and remembered. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Migration from Central America has garnered much debate in the United States. Right-wing politicians have demonized migrants, while activists have called for human dignity. But frequently missing from such discussions has been the brutal history of U.S. intervention in the region and how it has led to poverty, displacement, and violence. So argues Aviva Chomsky in her book, Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration, which is published by Beacon Press. Chomsky is a longtime activist in the Latin America Solidarity and Immigrants' Rights Movement and professor of history at Salem State University. Aviva, can you tell us why it matters if we remember the past in Latin America? What's at stake?
Well, there's a number of different things at stake, I think, for those of us who are in the United States. I guess I would say the two most important is how we talk about immigration, and second, how we talk about U.S. foreign policy. And in both cases, I think the history of U.S. relations with Central America, of Central American revolutions, of U.S. attempts over long periods of time to crush Central American revolutions and impose its economic model on Central America, are really the sort of hidden history, both of U.S. foreign policy and of understanding Central American immigration. So I've done a lot of work on immigration, immigration policies, the ways, thinking about the ways people talk about immigration. And one thing that's really struck me is that for those of us who lived through those years of the 1980s, Central America and the revolutions there and U.S. policies there were sort of very front and center and present in our consciousness. But for my students today, both Central American immigrant students and Anglo-U.S. students, those years have simply been erased, those events. And that really distorts the way we understand immigration. And it also distorts the ways that we think about U.S. foreign policy.
And is that something that is just simply part of the cycle of generations, that younger people are not going to know things that people who live through them do know? Or are there forces that lend themselves to such amnesia about the, you know, not too distant past and its relationship to the present?
Well, I think that there are certain things about history that are very deeply embedded in our consciousness that we are reminded of year after year with our national holidays, that are built into the curricula so that elementary school, middle school, high school students are exposed to them again and again, that the general population is exposed to through film, through mass media. So I don't think it's just a question of, I mean, of course, those of us who lived through the 1980s have memories that people who were born in the 1990s don't have. But we're all exposed to history, and we all internalize certain understandings of history. So I think there are parts of history and analyses of history that are very deliberately given to us again and again, and there's also parts of history and analyses of history that are very deliberately erased for us.
And the erasure of memory, as you note, is not a recent phenomenon, and we'll talk a lot about memory as it relates to the period you're speaking about, but I wonder if you can talk about the erasure and also sort of transformation of memory as it dates at least to the beginning of the Spanish conquest in the Americas, since you argue that that is relevant in understanding the state that Central America is in today.
So, of course, the Spanish conquest is something that that we are taught about, both in school and in the media and in our holidays like Columbus Day. And I think the way that we are presented with the Spanish conquest, I guess I would say there's two aspects to it. One, we're always taught a pro-colonial history. We're taught to identify with the colonizers. And even when we learn about the American Revolution, I would argue, which we're taught is an anti-colonial revolution, but we're actually taught to identify with the colonizers, and I would say that those who carried out the American Revolution, what we call the American Revolution, the U.S. American Revolution, were in fact the colonizers. They were the white settler colonizers. And this is something that makes the American Revolution quite unique in the history of anti-colonial revolutions, that it was a revolution carried out not by the people who were colonized, that is the Native Americans, the enslaved Africans and African Americans. It was not their revolution against the white colonizers. It was a revolution by one portion of the white colonizers against another portion of sector of the white colonizers. So it was really a colonizers' revolution, and the way we're taught to celebrate and laud the American Revolution is actually a part of a larger identification with and celebration of colonialism. So when we in the United States learn about Spanish colonialism, on one hand, we learn the larger general pro-colonial version of, voyages of discovery and exploration, all these celebratory themes that go with the way we learn colonialism. But at the same time, there's another aspect of colonialism, which is a British anti-Spanish colonialism. That is, we have two European powers vying for each other, and the British justify their colonial projects by denouncing Spanish colonialism. So the Spaniards are the evil colonizers. They are the conquistadors. They are the ones who go around killing people, whereas the British celebrate their own colonial project as much better than the Spanish. They are the ones who are bringing the, as the French call theirs, the civilizing mission, the mission civilisatrice. So there's what we call the black legend in Anglo-American historiography, which looks at Spanish colonialism as the epitome of evil, as a way of justifying British and U.S. American colonialism. So clearly, there were lots of atrocities committed by the Spanish in their colonial project, and of course there were lots of atrocities committed by the British in their colonial project as well. But we should also be careful when we're condemning the Spanish not to fall into this black legend of, oh, the Spaniards were the really bad colonizers, and we British and Anglo-American colonizers are rectifying all those wrongs. And we see that coming up, say, in the Spanish-American War, in Cuba and the Philippines, where U.S. colonialism and atrocities and massacres and genocides are justified in the name of how terrible the Spanish were. And so, you know, we're better than the Spanish, so we have the right to do all of these terrible things, and our terrible things don't count.
And so whether the focus is on the colonizers from one camp or another, one thing that is sort of left out in both versions is the history of the indigenous people who are erased from all of these histories. And as it relates to Central America, that is something that there's, as you argue, a kind of continuity right up to the present. But I wonder if you could speak to the erasure of the indigenous and their history in the memory of this region.
Yeah, so the official histories of pretty much every country are written by the ruling elites of the country. And the country is defined as the country of the ruling elites. So in the United States, the history that we are taught is the history of Anglo-American colonization and what we call DWEM history, dead white European male history. And in Central America, too, the indigenous populations, especially in some countries like Guatemala, are much larger. But the history of their... So the history of the U.S. American Revolution against colonial rule was almost completely a colonizers' rebellion aimed at expanding the colonial project. And indeed, if you look at what happened, so the leaders of it were land speculators, slaveholders. And if you look at what happens after the success of the revolution, is a continuation of the colonial project. That is, the institution of slavery is maintained far longer in the United States than it is in the colonies that remain under British rule, where it's abolished much earlier. It's preserved until the last possible moments here in the United States. And the history of imperial expansion, that is, those 13 colonies that fought for independence occupied just a tiny sliver of the eastern coastline, but immediately embarked on a century of colonization and expansion and genocide against the native populations to the west of those original 13 colonies. So the independent, the colonies upon independence embark on a project of permanent warfare and expansion against the indigenous peoples of the country, of what becomes the country as the country expands. And of course, its history is, or the way its history is written, is a history of celebrating this. Now, Latin American independence was a little bit different. There were much larger indigenous populations in Latin America, and especially after the Haitian Revolution, which was the second American Revolution after that of the United States. And I always put quotes around this term, America, because in the United States, it's generally used to refer just to the United States. But in Latin America, it refers to the Americas, North, South, Caribbean. And there's a lot of resentment against the way the United States has appropriated the term America for itself when all peoples of the Americas are Americans in not by nationality, but by continent, that America refers to the continent, not the country, from a Latin American perspective. So the Haitian Revolution, in a way, we could say, was the first actual anti-colonial revolution, starting in 1791, where it's actually the colonized people, the enslaved Africans, and Afro-descendants in the French colony of Haiti who fight not for white supremacy and ongoing colonization, but who fight against colonialism. And not just for the expulsion of the French, but of the ending of the plantation system, for the ending of slavery, and to establish a free black country on American soil. In the island of Haiti. And the name is changed from the French Saint-Domingue to the indigenous name of the island, Haiti. And the entire French colonial system is dismantled by those colonized. Instead of, as in the United States, the colonial system simply changing masters from the British to U.S.-American white colonizers. So the Latin American revolutions that happen at post-Haitian Revolution fall somewhere into the middle ground. That is, they all promise an end to slavery. They all promise the liberation and incorporation of indigenous peoples rather than continued conquest of indigenous peoples. That is, the United States was formed as a white country. Explicitly, only white people were allowed citizenship. People of African descent were not allowed citizenship until after the Civil War. Native Americans were not allowed citizenship until 1924. And citizenship wasn't de-racialized until after World War II. Asians were still excluded from citizenship until after World War II. But in Latin America, citizenship was universalized, and the independence movements called for universal citizenship, called for the abolition of slavery, and called for equality and the abolition of different statuses that had been enacted by Spanish colonial rule. Yet, those who emerged as the power holders tended to come from the white Creole and mestizo elites of the Spanish colonies. And it took them some time to abolish slavery. It happened well before it happened in the United States, but it didn't happen immediately. And their attitudes and policies towards the indigenous populations were very Europeanized, viewing and their ideas about economic progress and economic development were based on integration into the Euro-Atlantic economies, developing plantation economies, and seeing the indigenous populations as an obstacle to progress, who had to be integrated. And this is very similar to what's happening in the United States at the time, in the late 19th century, by taking away their lands and turning them into individual citizens on paper, but subject to laws like debt peonage and vagrancy laws that turned them into a proletariat, an exploitable workforce, by expropriating their lands and legally requiring them to work in the name of progress and economic development. So independence and the nation states that emerged out of independence in Latin America, I would say, fall into a kind of a middle ground between the overtly, openly country for whites only, white supremacy of the United States, and the complete overthrow of colonial institutions and ideologies that happened in Haiti.
Historian Aviva Chomsky is my guest. We're discussing Central America's forgotten history. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I wonder if you could tell us about the roots of U.S. involvement in Central America. Going up to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's good neighbor policy, which was initiated in 1933.
Okay, so this actually makes a really good transition from what we were talking about before, because I was describing U.S. independence as a colonial, not an anti-colonial, but a pro-colonial project aimed at expanding colonization. And I described the 19th century as one of ongoing warfare against and subjugation of Native American peoples on the continent. But this didn't end at the end of the 19th century. And in fact, even before the end of the 19th century, of course, the United States goes to war with Mexico in 1848, and its victory in the Mexican American, well, its victory in the Mexican-American War in 1848 doesn't end warfare, but just moves the warfare to a new stage, because although Mexico claimed those lands in what's now the Western United States, what was then Northern Mexico, the population was autonomous indigenous people. So the end of the Mexican-American War means the beginning of the Indian Wars of the 19th century, because the United States now claims the territory, but in order to actually establish its sovereignty, it has to subjugate the indigenous peoples. So the expansion of U.S. territory and U.S. capitalism in the 19th century doesn't end at the frontiers of the country. Those frontiers keep expanding, but it also expands into the Caribbean and Central America, and of course across the Pacific into the Philippines in 1898. But even before that, U.S. corporations are moving into Central America and seeing it as a site, a field for investment and profit. And one of the most important ones is the United Fruit Company, founded in my own hometown of Boston in the late 19th century. And there's several other fruit companies that that get involved on the Atlantic coast of Central America, producing bananas for sale in the United States. The United States also becomes involved in 1823. President Monroe declares the Monroe Doctrine, saying that Europeans are not welcome in Latin America. Latin America is the backyard of the United States, and that if the United States ever sees European involvement, it reserves the right to invade, to kick the Europeans out. Now, this expands to mean European economic involvement. So U.S. banks try to take over and succeed in taking over Latin American countries' debts, and then imposing complete economic control. And this is especially in the first decades of the 20th century, what's known as dollar diplomacy, when the United States invades and occupies Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, under this idea that the United States must maintain economic control. And if these countries contract debts to European banks, U.S. banks are going to take them over, kicking out the Europeans. And if they have debts to U.S. banks, then the United States will take over their economies to make sure that those debts get repaid. So that requires military occupations of the countries. So we have both of these things simultaneously going on in the late 19th century, early 20th century, military involvement, occupation, and economic control through both direct military and political control, and also through governmental control, and also U.S. corporations taking over vast tracts of Central American land. The other major product that Central American modernizers and elites are trying to export is coffee. And the United States doesn't take over the production of coffee, but the United States is the main export market for coffee, and it's also the main financer of the expansion of the coffee economy. So as Central American countries are establishing their independence, I should say Central American elites are establishing their country's independence, they're contracting debts with the United States, governments are, private enterprise is, and the governments and private enterprise are very closely intertwined. And the United States is really establishing military, political, and economic control over the areas that it considers its backyard, Central America and the Caribbean being these primary areas. So you said up until the good neighbor policy, one of the ways that the United States does this is through alliance with members and sectors of the elites of these countries. So if, and we can look at what happened in Nicaragua as kind of a classic example, the United States occupies it for several decades, and it trains and creates and arms a military force called the National Guard, with the idea that this National Guard will take over the rule of the country in the interests of the United States. And in fact, this is exactly what happens. The United States withdraws from Nicaragua in 1933 and leaves power in the hands of Anastasio Somoza, the head of the National Guard, who was trained and formed and armed by the United States. And the Somoza, and so this is the good neighbor policy under Franklin D. Roosevelt. We're not going to intervene anymore because we have everything all under control through our allies now. So as long as the governments there remain subservient to and carrying out the wishes of the United States prefers not to intervene directly. And that's basically the status quo during the 1930s and through the 1940s. But by the 1950s, as we're moving into the Cold War, the United States, and as some challenges to these U.S.-dominated elite rule are emerging, especially in Guatemala with the October Revolution of 1944, if Central American countries become too independent, the good neighbor policy goes out the window, as it does in Guatemala when the United States sponsors an invasion and coup in 1954 to overthrow the democratically elected populist government.
Well, tell us more about that period. U.S. policy towards Central America during the Cold War, and the degree to which there was, coming out of these countries, resistance to both U.S. imperialism and elite rule locally.
Of course, the period after World War II put a lot of challenges in the way of European colonialism. Many colonized people were mobilized to fight for their European colonial masters during World War II. And the European countries, especially the major colonizers like Britain and France, were devastated during the war. And I think there was a real... And, of course, the Soviet Union was fighting on the side of the United States and the Europeans against Nazi Germany and Japan. So the Soviet Union also gained in a lot of international prestige during World War II. So the whole international balance of power was sort of shaken up during the Second World War. And anti-colonial movements were gaining traction. Many of them had their roots in the post-World War I era or even earlier. But after World War II, a sort of a revitalization. So we have anti-colonial movements in Africa. We also have this Cold War contradiction where the European powers in the United States are trying to promote themselves on the world stage as these sort of paragons of democracy and freedom and equality. And yet the contradiction is the racism, exploitation, colonialism, like none of those fit the image that the United States and the former European powers are trying to promote of themselves. In this Cold War context, like the Soviet Union is the bad guys and we are the good guys, but we don't look so good. So the civil rights movement in the United States and the Black Power movement are also part of this sort of global challenge to the colonizers, like live up to what you're saying. You know, your image does not match the reality. And the United States and the European powers are also kind of buying into this Cold War. Hey, we do have to do something to look better if we want to maintain our global power. We can't be so overtly racist and colonialist. So the European colonial empires start breaking up. The United States starts breaking up the Jim Crow and legalized segregation system. And in Central America too, these movements for democracy, for rights, for labor rights, for more equal distribution, for rights to control their own destinies, are also really growing. So one of the first places where we see a revolutionary movement coming to power is in Guatemala in 1944, what's called the October Revolution, inaugurating what is known as the 10 Years of Spring in Guatemala, where military rule, the U.S.-supported military rule, is overthrown, and a reformist government promoting democracy, democratic elections, labor rights, land reform, social reforms on all different levels, education, flourishes, and popular movements are flourishing. Now, the United States is very threatened by this, and again, in the Cold War context, the United States sees a communist threat everywhere. But the communist threat isn't really a threat of Soviet involvement. Remember that the USSR is also devastated by World War II. You know, that's where most of the fighting took place. None of the fighting took place in the United States. The United States emerges as really the sole global superpower, the only major power that's not destroyed by the war, because China, Japan, European countries, USSR are all devastated by the war. That the United States sees communism everywhere there is anti-colonialism or movements for social justice and popular mobilizations and challenges to U.S. corporate domination. In the case of Guatemala, the corporate domination is very direct. It's one company, the United Fruit Company, that occupies something like one-third of the country's territory. And the land reform and the labor reforms are direct threats to the United Fruit Company's status and domination in the country. So, you know, this is a case that has been really deeply researched, how the United Fruit Company goes about trying to manipulate Congress, manipulate the U.S. public, plant stories and articles that there is a communist threat in Guatemala. And it's a threat to the United States, and the United States must intervene to overthrow it, which they do by what is to become a common theme in U.S. Involvement in Central America in the subsequent years of selecting and training a proxy army and then supporting their invasion to overthrow the elected government and implement a savage repression of all movements for social change, including the labor movement, the peasant movement, student movements, and basically leading to what the United Nations ended up terming a genocide in Guatemala that occurs in the 1980s. It's a direct result of the reestablishment of military rule directly by the United States in the 1950s. And the bloodbaths that tend to follow, Guatemala is not the only country that suffers this. And, you know, when the United States gets involved, what we see is bloodbaths, especially of those that the United States and local elites consider threatening or subversive to the economic model they think these countries should be following.
Historian Aviva Chomsky is my guest. We're talking about her book, Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration. That's published by Beacon Press. And you can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. She's professor of history and coordinator of Latin American studies at Salem State University. Her other books include Is Science Enough? 40 Critical Questions About Climate Justice. So you've been describing sort of decades of crisis, but many crises came to a head in the 1970s in Central America, where, of course, it was a period of global economic contraction. And many of the contradictions you're describing came to the fore. Can you talk about that period as a moment setting the stage for what took place a decade later when Reagan came to power?
Especially in the wake of the Guatemalan coup and the Cuban Revolution of 1959, that the U.S. policy toward Central America in the 1960s is one of, and remember the Kennedy administration and the Alliance for Progress and the idea that we're going to prevent revolutions by promoting reform. Unfortunately, the kind of reform that the United States tries to promote is more export agriculture. That's the solution to the global economic crisis, and that's the solution to poverty and underdevelopment. These are the development decades. But the model of economic development is really eerily similar to the model of economic development that caused all of the inequalities and land loss and labor exploitation to begin with. That is, it's the promotion of export agriculture. And there's a great book that came out in the late 1980s called Export Agriculture and the Crisis in Central America, looking at how the United States is pouring money into the development of new export industries, especially cotton, sugar, and beef industries that lead to another wave of land loss, proletarianization, labor exploitation, and impoverishment for the rural populations and especially the indigenous populations. Again, depending on the country, Guatemala especially, where there's a very large indigenous population. Other countries like El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, where most of the rural population no longer identifies as indigenous, which is a whole other long history to recount, where indigenous languages are less widely spoken, but where rural poverty is really endemic, and the form of economic development that the United States is pushing is actually accentuating rural poverty. And pushing a lot of rural people into marginalized urban slums. So the situation of crisis is definitely increasing in the 1970s, and revolutionary movements are growing, promoting something quite similar to what the Guatemalan government of governments of 1944 to 54 were promoting, a different model, a redistributive model, where instead of taking from the peasants to create more economic growth, more profits, more exports, emphasis on what we would today call food sovereignty and redistribution. And of course, these are immediately termed communist and anti-development by the United States. But in 1979, the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua is successful. And this gives great hope and optimism to the revolutionary movements in El Salvador, which coalesce into the FMLN, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, and in Guatemala. So we have armed revolutionary movements, and we also have urban and rural popular movements. We have the Catholic Church getting deeply involved in popular movements, popular education, Christian-based communities, liberation theology, taking on the idea that the coming out of the Second Vatican Council in Rome, that the mission of the Catholic Church is not what it has been historically in Latin America, although it's always been divided, but mostly to convince the poor to accept their fate, that the meek shall inherit the earth. But instead, liberation theology preaches that it's the will of God for us to bring about justice on this earth, not to convince the poor to just be passive and wait because they'll get justice in the next world, that the will of God is for us to bring about justice in this world. So liberation theology plays a huge role because the Catholic Church and the rural church, the popular church, are very deeply embedded in these in Central America, in Latin America, but especially in Central America. So all of these factors coalesce in revolutionary movements that really combine Christianity, radical Christianity, and Marxism of different sorts. But one thing that they do not have is support from the Soviet Union. So when we talk about Marxism, we have to be clear that these are domestic and local anti-capitalist ideologies and movements that base their calls for social justice on critique of the injustices that savage capitalism have brought to their countries.
Reagan took office in 1981, and he ushered in a new and very bloody period in Central America's history. I wonder if you could tell us how Reagan shifted things and how his policies should be seen in relationship to the past in terms of continuity and rupture from earlier U.S. policy towards Central America that you've been describing.
So I think that there are some very important fundamental continuities. The idea that anybody who challenges U.S. dominance is going to be tarred with the epithet of the day. In the post-World War II period, it happens to be communism. In earlier periods, those who challenged U.S. domination, capitalist domination, were termed bandits. Later, they're termed terrorists. But the idea that Central Americans are supposed to be the political and economic backyard of the United States, that didn't begin with Reagan. The idea that the United States will intervene militarily to bring about its preferred social order in Central America, and that anybody who challenges that social order just needs to be wiped off the face of the earth, those are not new to Ronald Reagan. The Cold War context, that is, Reagan is able to mobilize Cold War anti-communism. This is also not new. Obviously, it happened in Guatemala in the 1950s. But it's kind of bizarre in the 1980s when both the USSR and China are becoming capitalist and the United States is reestablishing good relations with those countries. But the real communist threat is poor people in Central America fighting for their rights. And yet Reagan tries to sell this to the U.S. public in Cold War anti-communist terms. But the other thing that's different in the 1970s is the enormous popularity, or the 1980s, the enormous popularity of the Nicaraguan Revolution and the hope that it gives to reformists and revolutionaries in other countries of Latin America, that such a small, weak, poor country can actually make fundamental social change, even under the opposition of the United States. And the successes of the Nicaraguan Revolution in its first years are really dramatic and really inspiring to many. And I think the Central American revolutions as these sort of underdog revolutions of people fighting for their rights create enormous hope and international support and inspiration, including in the United States. So I have a whole chapter about the solidarity movement in the United States and support for Central American revolutions and opposition to U.S. policy, and really deep critiques of U.S. policy are quite widespread during those years.
Well, and then connected to that, how has the history of that kind of resistance that took place in Central America in the 1980s and beyond resistance, the attempts at sort of radical transformation of societies in Central America, how has that been erased both in Central America and the U.S., and how do you understand that erasure, the importance of doing so?
Yeah, and this is kind of taking us back to where we began, right? I would say in the United States, the need to demonize the Nicaraguan Revolution and the revolutionary movements elsewhere, and to erase their successes and to crush the hopes and inspiration that they inspired. And I'm thinking here of another great book title by William Blum, Killing Hope, that the goal of U.S. foreign policy is to kill hope. And not just foreign policy, but domestic policy too. That erasing the potentials and hopes of those years has been really fundamental to the way the history has been taught or not taught or distorted in the United States. If a small poor country succeeds in escaping U.S. domination and actually succeeds in making life better for its people with very few resources and under constant attack by the United States, we aren't supposed to know about it. So we're only supposed to know that anybody who challenges the United States is bad and the United States is good. So I think from a U.S. perspective, erasing the crimes committed by the United States in Central America and erasing the revolutionary potentials and revolutionary successes in Central America. Now, when I say the history, I'm obviously not talking about professional historians, because there's many historians who do write about those things, but they don't really make it into the popular sector. So if you look at school curricula, if you look at movies, if you look even at what, you know, newspaper articles say about the 1970s and 1980s, those histories of potential and revolutionary potential have been almost completely written out of popular history, we could say. In Central America, the revolutions in all of the countries, the revolutionary movements were in Nicaragua voted out of power in 1990 after 10 years of unrelenting warfare by the United States that the U.S. Insisted would continue unless the revolution was voted out of power, or the revolutionary candidate was voted out of power. The revolution in many ways in Nicaragua continued. That is, the institutions of the revolution and the constitution were all established. The revolution established a democratic system, and the democratic system voted them the Sandinistas out of power. In Guatemala and El Salvador, the revolutions were essentially ended with peace treaties signed between the revolutionaries and the government in El Salvador in 1992, in Guatemala in 1996. But the horrific repression that took place during those years, not only of mobilized and armed revolutionaries, but against poor people in general, against indigenous people in general in Guatemala, against the rural poor. And a lot of disillusionment, I think, followed the peace treaties, because most of the people who suffered from the repression during those years, things did not really get better for them. And there was a lot, there has been a lot of disillusionment with the whole revolutionary process, and even with the idea of hoping for change, because in some ways, despite the fact that the wars were ended by negotiated solutions, the goals of the revolutionary movements, things like agrarian reform, true citizenship, access, equality, those goals were crushed. And that killing of hope, I think, is really prevalent in Central America as well, especially because of the ways that the peace treaties paved the way for the neoliberal revolution of the 1990s and the 2000s. So that the end of the war did not bring about an end of the conditions that had caused the war, and did not even bring about an end to the violence. And in some of the countries, levels of violence, interpersonal violence today, are higher than they were during the years of the actual war.
Well, let me ask you about that in the time that we have left. Unfortunately, our time has flown by. What is the connection then now between the migrations that we hear about, the so-called crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border with migrants from Central America? What is the connection between those migrants today and the U.S.-backed wars in the 1980s and the peace accords of the 1990s, which, as you say, set the stage for economic restructuring and austerity in Central America?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that the connection with the U.S.-backed wars is that the U.S.-backed wars set the stage for this neoliberal economic restructuring. And in some ways, the neoliberal economic restructuring restored the traditional power structures and the idea that the export economy, the dispossession of indigenous and rural people in the name of economic development and proletarianization is the route to progress. There's also some things that are quite new about the new neoliberal era of the 1990s and into the 21st century. The maquiladora sector, that is the outsourcing of U.S. industry into Central America, export processing zones all over. The huge promotion of tourism, which is another sort of extractive export sector, the commodities boom of the first decades of the new century, leading to huge increases in extractivism of natural resources. So, you know, it's not like a complete repeat of the past, but austerity, cutbacks, and the destruction of hope. So that the neoliberal era has been a true socioeconomic and political disaster for most of the populations of Central America. These are also countries that had become very heavily armed and that the United States continues to pour arms into. The drug wars and the drug trade have also contributed to the sort of breakdown of society and social supports. And the real dismantling of any kind of social welfare functions of the state have left the majority of the populations of these countries in really dire and devastating situations. So I would say that most of the refugees we see coming to the United States today, and I call them refugees even if they don't have legal refugee status, which is a very specific legal status, but they are fleeing the devastation of neoliberalism. And that Central American neoliberalism is a very direct result of the crushing of the revolutionary alternatives.
Aviva Chomsky, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Aviva Chomsky is the author of Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration, which we've been discussing today. That's published by Beacon Press and at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. Her other books include Undocumented and Is Science Enough? 40 Critical Questions About Climate Justice. Aviva Chomsky is professor of history and coordinator of Latin American studies at Salem State University, and she is a longtime activist in the Latin America Solidarity and Immigrant Rights Movement. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.
That concludes our show for today. We would like to thank Sasha Lilly for her permission to rebroadcast this important interview and critical reminder about the importance of history. Thanks also to the hardworking staff at KBOO for all that they do to keep community radio alive in Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host this morning. Join the Moles again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. when we return for our regular programming. I'm going to leave you today with a bit more of the song by Carlos Mejia Godoy, Yo Soy de un Pueblo Sencillo.
Que aún le duelen las heridas. Yo soy de un pueblo nacido entre fusil y cantar, que de tanto haber sufrido tiene mucho que enseñar. Hermano de tantos pueblos que han querido separar, porque saben que un pequeño juntos somos un volcán, porque saben que un pequeño juntos somos un volcán.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information at lwvpdx.org.